Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman. For 50 years, Greenpeace has been fighting for ecological justice. Now, arguably the preeminent non-governmental voice instigating environmental change and action, Greenpeace has focused the lens on addressing climate change, deforestation, overfishing, commercial whaling, genetic engineering, and orchestrating anti-nuclear campaigns. In 2019, there were approximately 4,000 staff workers for Greenpeace International and its offices around the world, along with tens of thousands more volunteers and passionate activists. The coordinating body of Greenpeace International represents the collective actions of 27 independent national and regional organizations in over 55 countries and regions across Europe, the Americas, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific. Joining for episode 99 of Sourcing Matters is the executive director of Greenpeace International, Jennifer Morgan. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join. I really appreciate it, all the way from Berlin, Germany.
Sure thing. Good to be here with you.
So let's start here. In the introduction, I mentioned many moving parts all over the world taking on some of the biggest problems facing humanity. How do you make sense of all of this?
What we've learned over the years is that actually there's quite a lot that connects all of these big interlinking challenges. And I think that became even more obvious during this COVID crisis. And I think the underlying system that we have, the system that really prioritizes short-term economic growth for a few, instead of prioritizing the well-being of many people and also of the planet. I think if you look at that and look at the root causes to climate change, to biodiversity loss, to overfishing, you start getting a sense of number one, what we need to change, and number two, what we're up against as well.
Yeah, and I think many of the stories being told are around the perils and the problems and not necessarily the solutions of change, the connective tissue that brings us all together and makes us take a deep breath and realize, well, within a generation, we can solve these problems. How do you find, or what have you found successful in bringing some of that connective tissue forward to instigate more change?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that there's a lot out there on how we can work together to build a better world, that the solutions actually to a number of the problems that we're talking about are there. And I think it's really about a number of things. It's about shining a light on kind of where the power imbalances are, you know, some of the injustices that happen around the world of who's, for example, getting funds from recovery packages during this COVID time, but also to really building power and building movements together. I think that connective tissue you talk about, you know, what we see is that a mom who's working in Poland to try and stop a coal mine in her backyard, you know, is connected in with a farmer who's trying to make ends meet in the middle of the Amazon, and connecting those people so that they see that they're not alone, and actually are all working for this better world for them and their kids, is something that I find incredibly important and just really inspiring, because there are so many people out there working for change.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you find that commonality of people all over the world. I'm sure for you as an international body dealing with individuals, numerous languages, numerous different economic states, or even just development states of where things are at, dealing with different governments and stakeholders. How are you able to then bring that to the mix and share that with a global audience so that there's a bit of, you know, nothing's lost in translation?
I think there's two parts of that. I think one is, you know, that the Greenpeace offices that are around the world that are working in all the different countries, you know, they're very connected into what's happening on the ground there in their place. And so, you know, right now I know in, you know, the Czech Republic, I think there's a local discussion around phasing out coal. And so they're focused on that versus what might be happening in India right now around local farmers and trying to have them have more rights and be able to produce food more locally and sustainably. And then I think that there are these kind of more globalized issues. For example, you know, like deforestation and what's been happening in Brazil with the highest rates of deforestation for decades and fires breaking out in record numbers and connecting the dots so that people know if they're in Europe or in the US that the products that they're buying do include deforestation in them. The Greenpeace in the UK recently put out a study that showed that one of the supermarkets was selling chicken from a certain brand that was based on feed from the Amazon, that from land that had been cleared, right? And so it's connecting the dots all the way from the Amazon to the UK consumer, where then the UK consumer can say, no, wait a minute, I don't want this. I want optimally, I'd like a law or a trade agreement that would make sure this doesn't happen because it doesn't benefit me. And it also doesn't benefit the local farmer in Brazil.
Right.
So finding those stories that connect people through this globalized world we live in, I think, and then bringing the levers of change that one can do from the local to the global, that's incredibly important, I think, and holds people and companies and governments accountable.
Yeah, there's some uniformity. That's a challenge for everyone, right? Is to find those problems that are the underpinning of many of these scenarios. I think one of those that seems to garner the attention, maybe the headline of too many papers is around carbon. I do want to come back to carbon and what we have to do and be involved in that. But in noticing, in reading more detail and how you introduce yourself and with Greenpeace and underpinning of many of those areas, those focus areas that I had mentioned in the introduction, seems to be the preservation of biodiversity. Are you finding within the domain of public knowledge, has there been an awakening to the notion of preserving biodiversity to save the planet, to save ourselves?
I think that there has been a greater understanding of how we are so, as people, we are so connected with nature. We are dependent on it. And that we therefore need to live in much greater harmony with it. I think one of those examples is certainly around the fact that infectious diseases come from animals, from wildlife, and from the livestock that we keep. You know, the vast majority of new infectious diseases come from animals. And when you clear land for livestock, when you clear land for farming or for development, then you have this chance of releasing those infectious, the possibility of those infectious diseases. And I think that's becoming more clear. I think in China, actually, from our office there, we hear that understanding of the connection between us is growing. I think turning that understanding everywhere into actual action and therefore not buying some of those animals or reducing, you know, and eating less and better meat and dairy is really important. And I also, I don't know, maybe this is just living in a city, but my sense is that people having been in lockdown are more connected to the small things that happen and the seasons that change and their own local environment. And how much they need it, and how much it gives them strength to kind of go through this difficult period as well.
Yeah, taking a bit of a blessing here, right? We have more time to spend with family and more time to think about things, and really more time to spend with nature. It's been really a time of awakening, getting out, and people I talk to that spend an hour a day, at least, you know, strolling or hiking or getting out and being involved. And I think that awareness element, it couldn't find a better awareness campaign than that of immersing ourselves back into natural order.
I think that's true. I think we're, you know, at the same time, we're at such a crisis moment on the biodiversity and the preservation of biodiversity. And I think there are, you know, there's actually upcoming international treaty negotiations, both on the oceans, and the biodiversity in the oceans and on land, where, you know, we and others are working to try and get targets put into an international treaty that would preserve 30% or have 30% of the oceans actually protected. Believe it or not, there's not a high seas regulation that happens out there, which means it's kind of a bit like the Wild West out there. And those are things where we need to engage people and have them see, oh, wow, I can make a difference. I can try and influence the position of my country on that international negotiation so that we can be protecting the oceans and also land linked in with the rights of indigenous peoples to preserve that biodiversity, because we're losing on that one.
Yeah. And I think many people think of biodiversity loss as high trophic level, large animals, you know, big cats, which are a huge problem, no doubt, and maybe a bit of the canary in the coal mine, but it's everything from soil health to insects to, you know, all the way up the trophic food chain here, how essential this is for us to become aware of biodiversity loss. And I think I want to explore a bit more on the ocean side. So I've noticed that much of Greenpeace efforts seem to advocate against the tragedy of the commons, right? This specifically the protecting of trophic life within the oceans. From, I remember the iconic grainy videos of Greenpeace zodiacs, you know, the early days of getting between industrial whaling ships and their catch, and your large scale actions against illegal fishing operations throughout the globe, and even dealing with contamination impacting keystone species areas and the breeding grounds for those. So how, that's many different entities, and well, the sea represents 70% of the face of the earth, and vast majority of biodiversity is in the ocean. So how do you orchestrate your teams to be involved in some of this, either awareness approaches for dealing with ocean health and ocean biodiversity, or even kicking off new initiatives that that make governments and other NGOs aware of some of these problems?
Well, I think what we try and do is, well, from a global perspective, I think we organize teams across the world to work together to, well, to do a couple things. One is in an effort to try and get this Global Oceans Treaty, which is on the agenda, will be on the agenda in 2021. It was supposed to be on the agenda in 2020, but of course things got delayed. But in order to be doing the national work to see, okay, where is a government on its position about whether it supports this kind of 30% target or not, and then to put pressure on those governments, first of all, by raising attention. So last year, we had our ships underway in a pole-to-pole campaign that went from the Arctic to the Antarctic with scientists demonstrating and documenting the biodiversity of the oceans, but also, you know, taking on some of the greatest culprits there, those that are continue to trawl in, you know, drag those big nets across the bottom of the ocean floor to try and bring up fish and other species. We also would be working with scientists to put out a report that documented where this 30% target comes from. Why is that needed? How can you do that? How can you have science basically guiding the policymaking there? We also bring in stories and work. I think a newer campaign we recently had was on the Thai Union fishery, where that's one of the largest industrial fishing companies. And what we found, which is the case many places, was the slavery at sea that was happening. And so we worked to expose that and put pressure on that fishery fishing company to change both the way that it treats its workers, but also the way that it does its fishing. Or we've, you know, recently, you know, connected in with a similar company who can look at how we in Africa have been working with our ships to actually chase illegal fishing boats. Sometimes, believe it or not, we have more capacity than some of the local governments with our ships. And so we bring those ships to bear and to try and offer them up so that they can be doing some of this type of policing work that's needed. It's a whole range of things that adds up into some local wins sometimes in regards to really local communities whose fishing, who are losing their fishing stocks to these large industrial players, but then adding up into support for this global approach, which then would give us way more hooks and ability to hold governments and companies accountable.
Hmm. And as you speak to that, it's the environmental connection to social justice. And as you were speaking in the beginning of the conversation towards that, those connective elements and how the similar systems are interwoven and fascinating to see. Again, those solutions of change, I think, give people hope across the board that maybe we can solve some of these big problems with collective action. Jennifer, a bit more about your background. I'll read this for our listening audience, and I'll continue with the questions. So Jennifer Morgan is Executive Director of Greenpeace International, as we said. Formerly, Morgan was the Global Director for the Climate Program at the World Resource Institute. Additionally, she was the Global Climate Change Director at Third Generation Environmentalisms, which was the E3G, and she led the Global Climate Change Program at the Worldwide Fund for Nature. She is passionate about helping countries, governments, and individuals take positive action to achieve zero carbon future, and is a strong proponent of the need of companies to go green and to invest in sustainable technologies. So it seems, or it is, in Greenpeace's blood to take action to drive change, and it seems it's also in your blood too. But I would say some say that Greenpeace does more than just instigate change, but antagonizes it. Is that we can't just sit idle and ask nicely for change because ultimately nothing gets done? Do we have to poke the bear over again to drive change?
Absolutely. I've learned anything over all my years and the different organizations I've worked for is that, speaking truth to power and, poking the bear is incredibly important and needed, because, people are comfortable. People oftentimes, don't want to create, conflict, with others. But my experience is that if you don't have people who are pushing others out of their comfort zone, asking them to be accountable, even challenging them as individuals, as humans, as parents about what they're doing, it's very, very easy to just stay in this super incremental change and where things get a little bit better. But we now see that that little bit better is far away from enough. So I think, Greenpeace is there to engage people, to shift the power dynamics so that we can be having the solutions out there that are good for people and not good for the polluters that are there, and non-violent direct action, and bringing to bear those voices into the mix. I think that's a lot of what we can contribute to a much, a broad movement of groups which are all doing and playing their part in this bigger ecosystem of working to create that type of really transformational change that's needed very quickly.
Yeah, right. I mean, we take a few steps forward, but then it's 10, 20 steps back and things will sit idle and it doesn't. I think there's some positive trends here, at least because of the consumer and the constituent awareness. So whether you're talking about, elected officials or you're talking about leaders of businesses, they seem to be held accountable by their stakeholders, by their shareholders more often. Are you making a conscious effort to antagonize the investors, the purchasers, the voters, to make sure that they take this as one of their top, three, four things, a bullet point items when they go into the voting booth or to buy a product or a good?
Yeah, we are. And it varies in each part of the world. I mean, one example on the voter side of things was, in the in Europe, recently, well, last year when you had the, Fridays for Future, the youth movement here, Greenpeace was really out there in all countries. And we did this in the U.S. recently as well, encouraging people to vote for the climate. to really be looking, not taking a position on party or, you know, person, but really saying, look, here's the, we did scorecards, for example, in the U.S. Democratic primary process, and of course, looking at the Republican side as well. So providing that information, also really advocating in many instances that those candidates don't take funding for their campaigns from the fossil fuel industry. That is something you'll see Greenpeace doing in various parts of the world. I think one thing I think is quite important is, you know, yes, we'll work to try and shift companies, but it really needs to be about the system change. So just getting one company to voluntarily change isn't going to change the system. So what we're looking at is really, for example, in the financial sector, in the banking sector around the world, yes, we need to have individual banks shift, but actually we need financial regulation. We need financial regulation that's going to take climate change in as a material risk, looking at what are the costs of the impacts that are happening, you know, locally and around the world, and what is the risk of investing in fossil fuel or industrial agriculture, for that matter, moving forward. And that is a really active debate that's there. And Greenpeace, right now, we're running a campaign in Europe on the European Central Bank because they're looking at their rules. But in Japan, in China, I think the really shifting the financial sector is a huge priority. And people to ask, okay, where you know, I get my money out of a wall, right? My money, my bank card, but where is my money going? And where is my pension going? I think that's an area that I just see, well, not just Greenpeace, there's many other groups, 350 and many other groups that are working in this area, which is, I think, indicating the importance of it to create things quickly. Because the vested interest in each of these sectors is so massive, if you think about it, just holding on to the control that they have. So we need to find ways of cutting across all of that, and the financial sector is one of those.
It sure is. Seems to be the place to drive change quickest, or hopefully in that case. And yeah, stateside, man, I mean, most countries, I think, have used much of climate action and necessity to kick the can down the road to, you know it's a problem, but wait, and then it's intensifying, and there's always some other bigger crisis that gets the way. But stateside, it's just, I won't even call it, many may call it an embarrassment, but I like to think that we got a lot of opportunity to get better. How's that, right? We have
I think that's fair.
We have a good chance to show what we can really do in the next few years here, so. And in fact, speaking of the antagonizing change, which I thought was fascinating, some of the origins, I remember seeing a documentary on Netflix about the origin story of Greenpeace and how to change the world, with about really focused on Bob Hunter and the kind of the key team. I encourage our listeners to watch. It was fascinating just to see the level of passion and the commitment and, you know, being complacent and complicit just doesn't float in that mindset, and how we can then make that work in year 2021 now, and gain that same kind of following and interest to take this type of change. And, you know, I think it must be interesting for you to be running an organization with that type of origin, that type of, just that spark that began so much, to now see it flourish into a global instance that really is enacting change in so many corners.
Oh, it's an amazing place to be. I have to say, I'm very privileged and lucky to be at Greenpeace. And I think because of those origins that you speak about, which really is about, it's about courage, and it's about that kind of, you know, bearing witness and speak and taking risks to put yourself in between a whaling ship and a whale, or, you know, going into nuclear test bomb areas. I think we're, in a way, you know, just demonstrating back then with what we know so much more now, which is, you know, how we, it is about life and death. for so many people, how we engage in the next few years in the fight for climate justice. And I think what's inspiring about, if I may, about Greenpeace right now is that we're present in so many different countries, and it looks and feels different in each place. In each place you have those values that are there of speaking truth to power, of that those courageous actions. But what a Greenpeace looks like sitting in Russia versus a Greenpeace in South Africa or a Greenpeace in the U.S., of course, or Europe is very different. But that unifying thing of knowing how little time we have, the readiness, and we are so lucky because we are completely independent, because we're just we're funded by individuals, which is an amazing gift. Yeah. To be able to make those judgment calls and shift and be agile and look and see, okay, here's the opportunity that we have right now, and here's where we can be making a big difference. Whether it be, recently, it's an interesting time in the global climate space. In East Asia right now, things are moving, not fast enough, but Greenpeace in South Korea was quite involved in setting the benchmarks for the recent election to get the Green New Deal and into the party platform, into the government's platform. And now they've announced they're going to go to zero by 2050. And in Japan, you see now it's finally moving a bit. And in China, announcing as a surprise that this was before the U.S. election. So looks different. I love that. It's like the biodiversity inside of Greenpeace, and just incredibly committed activists and volunteers and staff who know how to make change.
Yeah. So where does Greenpeace play within the Paris Accord, a global action to try to drive some of this change in short order?
Well, I think within the Paris Agreement, we play in a number of different ways. I think the way we mostly play is every country, the global agreement as itself set the aim to keep global average temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is because of the dangerous nature of going above that and what that means. But underneath that, you have a series of national commitments, right? So each country is supposed to do what it pledged to do and came forward with. So how we engage in that then is, which were fine, but they were far from enough, right? And they're now supposed to be strengthening their commitments under Paris. And this is a key thing for the new Biden-Harris administration as well, is, how are they going to reenter into this international agreement? What are they going to put on the table as far as what the United States is going to do to move away from fossil fuels, to build up renewable energy, to have a more sustainable food system? And Greenpeace will, in each of those national debates, we will be working to both, have a phase out of the internal combustion engine cars and get the mobility systems there that are needed to get people around. We'll be working to, stop governments like the Norwegian government right now. They've given permits to go have drilling in the Arctic, which would allow more oil development, right? Which would continue this trend. So we're suing the Norwegian government. Has gone to the Supreme Court to try and stop that type of fossil fuel development. So we really are on the ground, I think, engaging with people so that these governments will not only meet what they have committed to do in the world 5 years ago, but go much further. To make sure that we don't cross those dangerous thresholds. It's a key time, actually. The 12th of December is the 5-year anniversary of the Paris Agreement, actually when it comes into force officially. And so we're, looking to bring pressure and wherever we can so that that agreement remains credible because countries are meeting their commitments.
I'd love for Biden and Harris and our whole new administration to flip it on its ear a bit here and not just reach the, or try to reach the original expectations, but really try to lead in developing those commitments, to your point of validating our claims. Let's get to a point where we're actually living up to the expectations and not having false expectations, or, you know, a nice, again, kick the can down the road. And maybe that's our chance. Maybe that is our opportunity right there to come full guns blaring and make a difference and make amends with so many of our allies we've seemed to alienate in recent months or years.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there are so many chances right now. And I think for this new administration to come in and demonstrate that it understands the science, that it understands the need to cooperate with others, and therefore they're going to go not just to reentry the Paris Agreement. You know, that's like a mini baby step. We need to look at shifting away, you know, from fossil fuel and into they need to put in financial regulation, as, you know, I mean, talking about that, bring that forward. And the environmental justice component of their platform needs to come and be, you know, life needs to be breathed into that and bring that into the international space, because the injustice is internationally. Imagine you're a small island nation, right? You don't have time or patience for a U.S. that comes in and out of agreements as, you know, as quickly as, you know, a person graduates from high school. So I think it's a great chance. I hope that the U.S. This administration will show some humility, but also just be bold and go, because we don't have time to pussyfoot around anymore.
Yeah. Bold. And as you had mentioned, courageous, which hopefully they're ready to do, right? And get out of these sandbox conversations and elevate the foolish concerns we have of some dinosaurs that still represent us. And we'll soon be out of out of existence, maybe. Then, and we'll move forward. But one thing that you had mentioned earlier, I think was a great phrase, was "Hey, money just comes out of the wall, right?" And similar to that is one of these unifying factors. Food just comes from the grocery store, right? I mean, it just shows up there. So we focus heavily here in the podcast around food and food, our food, what people eat, as materializing as a way to drive environmental awareness. Much of the global's population could choose food values as a way to take environmental action three times daily. So what do you think of that theory? Could food be leveraged more so as a broader environmental enlightenment tool, as an elixir to do more now?
Definitely. I mean, I think on a number of different levels. I mean, I think if you look at just the link to climate change. I mean, I think it was the Food and Agricultural Organization that found that if food waste was a country, it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, right? That's just the food waste part of things. And I think the way that people engage in the systems that they're supporting are directly linked into the health of our planet, whether that be on biodiversity or whether that be on climate. So, you know, reducing, if you're thinking about it and you want to, you know, reduce, do something for the environment, then looking at, you know, the food waste that you have. I mean, it's incredible how much food waste there is. You know, 30% of food is wasted globally. You know, shifting your diet so that it's more plant-based, so eating less and better meat and dairy is something that can have a big impact. You know, and then just really connecting in with local farmers and connecting with them and supporting the adoption of ecological farming practices. Now, those are just some of the ideas and issues that come to my mind when that I know we're looking at across the board to try and create a sustainable food system.
Yeah, it's there. Going back to the analogy of the states having a lot of opportunity, there's a lot of opportunity in food systems to alleviate the excessive cost of waste and just caloric export. We're ultimately mining our regenerative natural resources for short-term gain, which ultimately we're finding is not short-term gain. It's just pumping out more calories to stave off what's next. So I think it is an incredible chance. And You know, I think with food being really our most intimate connection to nature, and actually taking and consuming bits of nature and keeping us sustained and nourished and alive, it just seems like one of those mechanisms that we can go back to that idea of systems based, or you know, of bringing it all together, of a similar solution to many of these impending problems. Mm.
Yes, I agree, and I think it's true on a number of different levels. So I think, you know, sometimes people who maybe live in cities feel far away from it all, but actually cities are a great place to be also connecting in with nature through how you eat and how you actually get your food. So, you know, with 50% of the world's population living in urban areas, you know, looking at there how you can have allotment gardens and garden rooftops and collective community kitchens and zero food waste programs. And I think that can help you move out of your bubble of being in, you know, kind of removed from nature more, to really thinking, wow, this is where this comes from. And this is how I can be building up a different system that's much more based on ecological farming than industrial agriculture, where you just have these massive scale operations that are so damaging to the planet.
And it makes you realize how tough it is to actually grow food when you do it yourself.
Yeah.
And you don't want to waste it because it's so challenging to make it happen. It's like investigating good sunglasses. You know where it all goes. You know where it sits when you, instead of the cheap ones that you might destroy. So investing in good things and knowing the values of, I think, is a key part. But maybe a more acute problem to theirs is those that don't have access to enough food or nutriment in general, like food insecurity in the developing world and even within some of the richest countries in the world is real. We can't keep exhausting those regenerative natural resources just to create more caloric export and not get it to everyone that needs it. Is Greenpeace involved in addressing some of the food insecurity problems around the world?
We are. I think, you know, looking at how, you know, basically, I mean, there's a number of different levels of that, but I think working to have a fair, more inclusive and equal food system in countries. So in India, for example, we're quite involved working with local farmers to support them in getting more of the rights and the access into different local markets there. I think in the global scheme of things, we're quite involved in the EU Mercosur trade agreement between the European Union and much of South America, and working hard to try and make sure that there are environmental and human rights provisions in that agreement. Because, you know, as you said, in a way, these trade deals that have been there, I mean, if you think about a place like Brazil, which has had its history since industrialization based on pulling out these resources, whether it be coffee or cocoa, and then it's soy, and now it's, pulling out those resources and then exporting them to other countries with little benefit for local people in Brazil. And then Europeans, in this instance, actually importing those and causing deforestation basically in Brazil by what they're doing. And so we're working hard to try and get those types of provisions into that agreement so that you can actually be having much more food security in Brazil, in this instance, and other countries in South America, so that it can benefit the communities there, and really try and create a whole different alternative model there, a food model there that stays local and creates, and has food sovereignty, so that you have a prioritization for local agricultural productions rather than, you know, just exporting it at low cost to others.
Hmm. You had mentioned that you raise all of your money from end users, from people. And I think you're not beholden to dealing with corporate donations. With that, do you feel, or how do you get engaged in the conversation of corporate shareholders versus stakeholders? And do you think that corporations and their shareholders actually have a seat at the table for instigating environmental or ecological change?
Well, right now they have the biggest seat at the table, I would say. I think they have too big of a seat at the table. I think that, you know, what we see in so many countries around the world that you have in the decision-making processes in government, right? Who is in there making those decisions? Who has the policymakers' ears? That may either be due to the way elections are run in places like the U.S. or due to corruption in other places. So I think, well, first of all, I think they have a very big seat at the table and they need to have a less big seat at the table. And then second, I think those that are, I mean, I kind of see three different kinds of companies right now. I see one set of companies and sectors like the fossil fuel industry that are just holding on and trying to get everything that they can, also from public money through these recovery packages, because they see, you know, and they know that we have to make these steep declines, and therefore their business model and what they do is actually at risk, and they're holding on and they're fighting in every way that they possibly can, and opposing change. Then you have a group that's, I think, aware of the issues, and they're engaged. They sign statements, or they make commitments for different kinds of voluntary targets. But I haven't seen them yet on the floors of the U.S. Congress advocating for you know, a phase out of fossil fuels, or advocating for you know, a very high price of on carbon, if that was what was going to make a difference. And so they, I think, need now to shift much more into creating the rules and the laws that will then give them their certainty that they need, but will move us to zero on the emission side of things. And then there's a third group that totally gets it, that sees opportunity in it and are trying to move. Those are often smaller companies that are willing to kind of buck the system and try and make change. And I think, you know, there's more and more attention as to where companies are sitting on these things right now, across the board, not only on environmental justice, but of course on racial justice, on social justice. And I think they have to step it up, or you know, they're going to be held accountable for sure.
Right. One of the organizations or companies that seems to float amongst those three categories is, or tries to float amongst those, is Amazon. And, you know, Jeff Bezos came out with his Earth Fund, doling out about $750 million recently to different NGOs. From your point of view, at Greenpeace, is he a bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing, or is he actually the robber baron that has awoken to philanthropy and is trying to make a difference? How are you dealing with Bezos and Amazon?
Well, actually, Greenpeace is currently part of a campaign, hashtag Make Amazon Pay, which we've signed up to with allies in the labor movement, which is, you know, trying to get some equal pay for workers. Because if Jeff Bezos could pay all Amazon workers more than $100,000 a year and still have as much money as he did before the pandemic, then I think that he needs to step up and provide much better standard of living for the workers across the world that work for Amazon. I think in terms of his initiatives, I think that his company and how his company is engaging in climate, and how he's treating his employees and what the system he supports is more important. And I haven't seen enough there yet, that's for sure. And funding initiatives isn't going to cut it. We need, of course, you know, wealthy individuals to be funding things, but they shouldn't have a right to decide in a way. This is very different of kind of like a U.S. funding philanthropy model versus other countries. It's kind of like when you're very, very wealthy, then you get to decide, you know, where the money goes to. Well, no, actually, this is a public good, and there should be, you know, some dollars that you decide what projects you're going to support doesn't make up for the footprint of the company and both fighting on climate, but also for workers' rights.
Right. Yeah. Bringing back the aristocrats, right? So letting them heavily influence how everything is operating. And
exactly.
Yeah. That's a challenge across the board, not just obviously in environmental issues, but to all of this connective tissue, all of these systems-based approach, of course. So, well, Jennifer Morgan, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us for today's conversation. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great to talk, and hope all your listeners are well. And let's work together. We need every single person to be active right now, and everything you do can make a big difference. So stay with us.
Great insights. And thanks so much. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.